This podcast takes you into the rarely discussed realm of the personal decisions leaders have taken that have influenced their business decisions and developed them into the leaders they are today. The refreshingly honest experiences of those who have been very successful provide an insight into the challenges they faced, the successes they achieved, and the people who influenced them along their journey. Here's our host, Mark Silvera.
Welcome to Business Made Personal. With more than 30 years' experience in insurance broking and underwriting sectors, Paul Lynham is chairman of Adonna Australia, chairman of Resilium Insurance Brokers, as well as heading up the group pipeline and M&A activity. Paul was also the founding director of SRS Underwriting and Blue Broking and has led those companies through a time of dynamic growth and opportunity. He is also a past chairman of the Underwriting Agencies Council of Australia, as well as the recipient of the Underwriting Agencies Council Lifetime Achievement Award. Such a pleasure to have you with us today, Paul.
Thanks, Mark, and thanks for inviting me along.
Hey, Paul, let's start at the beginning. You know, no one chooses to get into insurance. What was your background like prior to work like? Were you a Brisbane boy? Where were you born and bred?
Well, I was born in Brisbane in the Royal Brisbane Hospital. I had seven brothers and sisters, five brothers, two sisters. We lived in the northern suburbs of Brisbane. My father died when I was quite young, so my mother brought us all up. We thought we all did all right and lived in this massive house. I drive past that house today and I don't know how children fitted into it, but we did. It was just a small shack, but we were happy. So I left school and got into the workforce, and in fact, through our legacy officer, joined a small jeweller in Brisbane. I used to run around Brisbane delivering their parcels for them. I then got into health insurance and I did quite well. And I think it was in the year that Bob Hawke was elected and I joined the Health Insurance Commission, which was essentially public service. And there I stayed for probably 4 or 5 years. I moved to North Queensland and a guy in Townsville offered me a job in general insurance. I think at the time I was a junior exec with the Health Insurance Commission. I was probably earning, I don't know, $60,000 or $70,000 a year. I said, come and work in general insurance. We'll pay you $15,000 a year, but we'll pay you 15% commission. I didn't know anything about insurance, but I thought, why not? So I went and joined this company. The first policy I wrote, which was about $1,000, so I'd worked out in my car driving back to the office, so I'd get $150. In fact, what I got was 15% of $150, and I thought, this is a disaster. So I sort of moved along and I thought, I need to do something where the premiums are larger, and eventually specialised in marine and aviation insurance, but predominantly aviation insurance, which sort of led into the Lloyd's market to get those risks placed. And then eventually met a guy called Barry North, and we were the original founders of SRS, and he worked for Sedwick and wrote a pub scheme, and we wrote to a number of brokers in Lloyd's and nobody responded to us. And then a guy called Bruce Kopp wrote back to us and said, you know, I think I can get you a facility in Lloyd's. It took him 12 months to get a line slip. The lead underwriter on it, from memory, was a guy called Jack Tresice from Cerema, and nobody would follow him, regrettably. Eventually, we got some underwriters on there, which from memory were Kiln and DP Mann, who supported it. They supported that facility. Well, in fact, Kiln supported that facility for the next, gee whiz, must be the next 20 years. That was great. And, you know, I remember when we started the business, we thought, well, we better go out and get a license. In those days, it was the Insurance and Superannuation Commission. And from memory, the guy that ran that, or the superintendent, was a guy, I can always remember his surname was Bates. So we needed to get a license, and from memory, the license was about $800. We didn't have any money. We were stone cold broke. I went and got a cash advance on my Visa card. My wife maintains it was a bank card, but I'm sure it was a Visa card. Got the cash advance on to get the license to start what in those days was called Lynham Pacific, but it was the same company that went through that became SRS.
Believe it or not, I do remember Lynham Pacific.
Wow, well, I've still got two key rings.
I want to ask you a little bit about those days, but before I do, you said something before that really interested me, that your father died when you were quite young and your mum brought up eight children.
Yeah, well, she did it. five boys and two girls. And I can tell you, there were some pretty rough moments with five boys. I was the second youngest, and I can remember having a stoush with one or two of my brothers, and my mother would launch herself into the middle to break it all up. So it was, look, they were fun days. We never knew any better. You know, we're quite well-to-do. And in fact, we were far from that.
What impact did that have on your attitude to business? Did you see aspects in that? Was there elements of wishing you could do certain things when other kids are doing it or anything like that where you've gone, okay, I need to do something to make sure that doesn't happen to me?
Yeah, look, I can recall being quite young and sort of manifesting, wanting to be successful. For me then wasn't probably what it was to be 20 years later, you know, a metallic green dragster like the guy up the street had or something. But I always wanted to do better. And I think that went on in life. I've always wanted to be able to provide for my kids, look after my wife and have a life that is comfortable.
I wanted to ask you, because you mentioned a couple of people in there, I wanted to ask you, who's been the most influential person in your life?
Look, there's probably one who is Bruce. And sadly, Bruce passed away about 3 years ago of lymphoma. But Bruce was a Lloyd's broker and a very, very good Lloyd's broker. We were together for a long, long time and he helped our business no end. He mentored me into the market, I guess helped me on my relationships in the Lloyd's market. He was a guy that could walk around and all day his mission was to increase our profile and our reputation in the market, which helped us no end. And I think the other person, strangely enough, is my wife, who comes from the insurance industry. Chris was with Suncorp, and from memory, she was the national distribution in the general insurance before she left to have our son Flynn. So that was 22 years ago. So having Chris there, and when I met Chris, strangely enough, I was already in the insurance industry. When I met her, I was making 7 p.m. telephone calls every night. And I'm just digressing, but if I tried to introduce that into a relationship, it would just be a disaster. But she understands it. In fact, when the kids were young, she would cook two meals a night. She would cook the kids and then a couple of hours later, because I spoke to the UK every single night of my life and sometimes on Saturdays. So it was pretty full on. But Chris, coming from insurance, still today, you know, I bounce a whole load of things off her, sit there and ramble at night. She still fixes my spelling mistakes. She's been hugely influential in my life, but the other person is Bruce. But you know, there's a whole load of people I think that I've connected with over the years. I've also always in business, and I think it's really important, is that I've always tried to surround myself with people that are better, smarter, that can help me. And I've always tried to look after those people, whether it be financially or through their careers or whatever.
People do talk about surrounding themselves with people who are better and smarter than them. I guess I wanted to ask you, how does that feel from your perspective? Because a lot of people would be daunted by that prospect, right? Having an employee that's either better or smarter than them. How did you deal with it?
I didn't have a problem because it is what's going to make you successful at the end of the day. And, you know, I had a guy that had worked for me for a long time and I'm still associated with. But, you know, underwriters, they have their book of business and they have their clients. And what I say to them is step away from that and delegate to other people to grow where you want to be. And for me, that was a big thing. It was to delegate the tasks out to people and let them go. So you've got to let go of your vulnerabilities in holding your goodwill to move up to the next step. Otherwise, you're going to get caught in the weeds forever and you just won't get anywhere. You'll stay where you are. You won't move.
I wanted to ask you about that. So I've spoken to a couple of people that can't let go of the weeds. It's where they feel that they're of value. It's where they feel that they make a difference. They started the business. They hang on to that micro aspect of the business for grim death. How did you end up letting go so that you could do some of those strategic things?
I didn't want to be in the weeds. I don't want to be in the weeds now.
Fair enough.
I'm quite happy not to be in the weeds. Yeah, look, to me, it was quite funnily enough, and I suppose you can look back now, but to me, it was just a natural thing. You know, I had always... Yeah, even when I was broking, my plan was to run a broking team and not, you know, be out. You know, like I was in North Queensland, I didn't want to be flogging myself in 36 degree heat out seeing clients every day. I'd rather stay in the air-conditioned office and pull the strings.
One of the sayings that I ask people about regularly is that, you know, the saying that says successful people are a result of the mistakes they make, but more importantly, what they learn from those mistakes. What do you think you've learned from some of the mistakes? Not that you've made many, But what have you learned from the mistakes you've made, Paul?
Oh, look, I've made plenty of mistakes, still make them today. But I think, you know, just take ownership, own the mistake and move on. I mean, unless it's, I've got a saying that a problem's only a problem if it is a problem in 12 months' time. Like if I do something now and it's still going to be a problem in 12 months, well, that's a bit of a disaster. And I also, and a guy once told me, he said, you know, when you're training people or whatnot, he said, give them enough rope and see what they do with it. So people are always going to make mistakes. Don't crucify them for it. Let them make a mistake and let them learn from it. And I think that's what I've done, is that any mistakes I have made, I've learned from them and moved on.
And speaking of things like that, was there a significant turning point in your life?
Which came from a mistake?
Well, you've just gone, you know what, I've got to reevaluate what I'm doing here because things may not have gone your way, or there was a real significant moment. You know, some people have talked about their security being pulled out from under them and now they've had to recreate a whole model. Was there any particular point in your life where it was a pivotal moment for your watershed moment?
There was, in fact, and I can actually remember the exact place that I was. Actually, there was two things. At SRS, we insured an abattoir, and an abattoir to me is a, you know, it's a little building out at Kilcoy and there's a few pigs and a couple of cows. And we'd had an abattoir loss. And I said, I remember saying to somebody, how big can an abattoir be? You know, they came around and they said, the loss is 60 million. And I went, oh, holy smoke, which we had a 15% line on. And I can remember our lead underwriter who was killed, and they put a punitive clause on us. But that day changed SRS Underwriting Agency from a property point of view, because that day it was serious. We had to be hugely accountable. And this was probably around, it may have even been pre-2000. It was a massive loss. We learned from it. And good came from it, but it changed that business model forever.
Was it to a point where you thought it would impact the continuation of the business?
Yeah, probably. It was serious. I mean, we delivered a major loss to the market, which was written with probably not a whole lot of thought on June 30, where somebody just put a line down, you know, because it was a small line, but it was a large loss. So that was a huge turning point in our business and changed the way that we did things. And then, you know, not far off that was, you know, HH folded, the independent folded, all the compliance came in and things really did heat up and life got serious. And I think a whole load of insurance brokers and MGAs. I recall at that time, the late Roy Ellis and Bob Lee, we were in the UAC and, you know, one thing that we wanted to do, we were either going to be controlled by ASIC and they were going to put the governance around the MGAs or would self-impose. So we put a lot of work into the self-imposed model to create the MGA platform where it sits today. And, you know, the MGA platform, and I don't even know what the numbers are. I hear plenty getting bandied around, some of them are massive. But, you know, if you go back to those days, the platform that was put in place has served well over time.
It's funny, the things that come out of adversity, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, well, it was sink or swim, and nobody wants to, you know, you don't want a bureaucrat putting the rules in.
You mentioned Roy and Bob. And you mentioned the UAC. In 2015, you were presented with the UAC Lifetime Achievement Award, as I said at the start of the introduction. What were your thoughts when you actually received that award?
I think I was more surprised than anything. You know, like I was following Bob and Roy, and I was a little bit younger, I guess. I had contributed to the underwriting agencies, and I guess I was reasonably well known in that sector. And look, to be brutally honest, I don't think I did a whole lot more than other people. But, you know, look, I was proud that I'd achieved that. And obviously with that on your, not that I need a resume anymore, I'm at my last stop. But, you know, to have that on your resume, you've got to be proud of it. I guess it's your peers recognising your contribution to the market.
I want to also talk about 2020, right? So 2020, you leave Epsilon Underwriting Agencies. You go out as a consultant and you're a consultant for 11 months. Was that a pivotal time for you? Were you thinking, well, what do I do from here on in?
I'd come out of Gallagher's and I went on, I had 12 months gardening leave. So I came home having worked for 22 years and, you know, under my gardening leave provisions, I couldn't contact anybody. I couldn't do this and I couldn't do that and I couldn't do anything. So I spent 12 months, I took up golf, which was probably why I worked, because I'm not a great golfer. I spent a lot of time at Bunnings. I've got a boat shed in my basement that is just full of snap shackles that I don't need. I don't know why. I go to Bunnings every day and I'd buy snap shackles, which I've still got lined up in my boat shed. I went to Epsilon and spent a couple of years there with Morgan and the team. And that was fantastic. But those guys, they were running a great business. And I texted David Ross and said, you know, I want to build a platform out here in Australia. And he was hugely supportive and said, yeah, that's great. So I resigned from Epsilon and my wife said, have you got a contract from Ardonna? And I said, no, it's all right. I don't need one. You know, I know those guys. It's fine. Plus, what can happen? And what's the world going to end? Be a pandemic? I think it was about 2 weeks later, the world closed down and I thought, oh, no. And in fact, Morgan phoned me back and said, look, do you want to come back? And I said, no. I've made a decision. I'm going to move. And so we pushed on and tried to find an opportunity. And, you know, I'm always very grateful to Adrian Kitchen for engaging with us on his business on Resilium. And the funny thing is that, you know, we went through that deal and the shareholders had never had one face-to-face meeting with the sellers through that transaction, which was, that was just unheard of. But, you know, that's what COVID brought. You know, there was a load of Teams meetings and whatnot, but, you know, they put the trust in to get the deal done and there wasn't a handshake. And in fact, I don't know how long after the guys actually came out, but it was quite amazing that staff were meeting each other. They may have been working for us for 6 months and had never been into the office. Our CFO, Rosalie Lau, we employed her and she started from home and it was months before she came into the office. It was quite a difficult time. And, you know, you look now at the whole work from home and I don't know, jury's out. I think that, you know, in my world, COVID has brought some upside around health and well-being, but you know, I'm sure that it's brought a whole load of mental health issues on the other hand. So, you know, jury's out there. But yeah, look, that was it was triumphant that we got a platform and Resilium has been very successful, which is great. And, you know, Ardonna have been very, very supportive. And for them to have the trust, I guess, initially in me to get that transaction done, because I was the only linchpin between the Resilium team and the Ardonna team. So, look, it was a challenge, but we got there.
And, you know, the vote of confidence in you is well-founded, having with your background, your experience. And I want to talk a little bit about that. So you have got extensive experience in business culture management, in merger and acquisition completions. You know, you've been involved with startup business opportunities. You do a bit of business coaching. I wanted to ask you, in terms of the Australian context, do you think we do that well as an industry?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that's proven. It's, you just got to, you know, read the press every day to see, you know, how this market's evolved, and it's evolved with AR and training. There's a whole load of M&A going on. You know, there's people selling their businesses every day and it's quite a competitive market. I think, you know, Robert Kelly has produced a great business in Steadfast and he's been able to manage a whole load of those different facets. And there's loads of other people around the place that are doing the same thing. So I think we do all those things really, really well. And I think we're probably a leader in the field.
Okay. Well, coming from you, I mean, you'd know, you've been involved in it for a long, long time. I want to go back. You've mentioned a gentleman by the name of Bruce Kopp, if I've got that right. He was clearly a mentor for you. How did he actually help you to develop your career?
Bruce was 10 years older than me. He had an excellent reputation in the Lloyd's market. He was a guy that, you know, he wore out a bit of shoe leather getting around to see underwriters. He had a very, very good reputation. He had very, very high standards. And I guess tried to push something through the easy route, he would say, no, that's not how we're going to do it. We're going to go the more difficult route, which is more sustainable, and we're going to have better relationships, et cetera, et cetera. So he was a very hard taskmaster and Bruce was pretty set in his ways. But for me, he taught me a whole lot, you know, introduced me to people, as I say, that have been lifelong friends. He was my daughter's godfather. And in fact, I was best man at his wedding at the In and Out Club in London back in when, what was his name, who kicked the field goal in the World Cup, the fullback.
I remember the event. I can't remember the guy's name.
So, no, Bruce was a hugely important part of my life. And in fact, I had lunch with his, which I still call it his wife, a couple of weeks ago. So I still very much stay in touch with the family.
What do you think he saw in you? What was the attraction for him?
He was in the Australian market. I guess if you reflect, he probably saw enthusiasm. We wanted to build a business prepared to take, you know, risk in developing the business. And in fact, and I'm sure he wouldn't mind, but, you know, we wanted him in as a shareholder. And I recall he had to sell his Caterham for about, I can't remember now, 60 or 70,000 quid to buy into the company. So his return on investment was extraordinary 20 years later. I think he saw the enthusiasm. He knew the Australian market very, very well. But look, I've no doubt that he helped us develop that business with his relationships. I mean, we were the only account that he looked after in London. So he spent all day walking around telling people about SRS, telling people about Paul Onum, telling people about Paul O'Leary, just talking up our game in the Lloyd's market. So he was invaluable from that respect.
Just switching tack a little bit with you, Paul Onum, what would you say is the most difficult part of being in your role?
I think it's like anything. It's probably keeping everybody standing, navigating the personalities and, you know, making sure everybody's happy. And, you know, that's what I seem to do. And I think anybody in a role like mine, that's what it's all about. It's, you know, it's managing personalities, because I take things on board and, you know, I take ownership of people's problems, although I try and push it back. I don't like to get too many monkeys on my back. But yeah, I think just managing people and personalities, and that's not when I say managing people from a disciplinary or anything like that, it's more just making sure that everybody is adequately happy.
Yeah. People come at things with different objectives in mind, right?
Yeah, look, there's some people, you know, different agendas and whatnot. I would like to think that I don't. Some people may say I do. I've got no idea. You know, for me, it is around trying to keep everybody moderately happy. You can't keep all the people happy all the time, but if you make a decent effort at most of the people, well, I think you've done your job.
If you could change one thing about our industry, what would you change, Paul?
That's an interesting question, and one I've never really put any thought into. If you gave me time, I could probably come up with quite a number. Look, there has been so much change in the industry over the past 20 years. If you go back 20 or 30 years to today, there has been enormous change. So, you know, I'm not one to introduce any more. There's nothing I can put my finger on and say, I think that should be changed. And in fact, I think we're in a pretty good spot at the moment. There's probably more change coming down the chute that's going to have people question, you know, what they want to do going forward, which I guess will produce more opportunities in the market. You know, there's no doubt that there's market will, or the industry will continue to change as government, you know, looks at all the different facets of the things on the table at the moment.
It's interesting, isn't it? If you look at the AFCA stats, and if you think about brokers, you know, the amount of complaints going to AFCA about insurance brokers is minimal. Yet, we are one of the most highly regulated industries, possibly even in the world, in terms of our compliance requirements, our legislative requirements. And I get that it's all for the good of the common people. I just wonder if we're now at a point where we are so tightly regulated that it's difficult to move. It's difficult, particularly for insurance companies, to make decisions that might sit outside the box.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, Lloyd's is full of actuaries now. I mean, the underwriters who are sitting in the room, you know, I'd imagine are continuously referring to their actuaries to get decisions made. You know, but on the other hand, if I go back 30 years, if I go back to 1998, you just don't want to go back there. If you can remember the general agent who wasn't tied and he had a few agencies here and there and they had no accountability, there was, you know, it was Rafferty's rules. So I think to where we are today, and look, I think the industry now is a good spot to be in and there's still plenty of opportunity.
It's interesting you mentioned 25 years ago or 30 years ago, because that was around the time that Steadfast started. And I've mentioned in a couple of the podcasts that I was the second employee. I think I was the general manager of Steadfast at the time. And in our constitution, we had that we would not accept an authorised representative because of exactly what you're talking about, the general agents and the perception at the time and possibly even factual of the way they went about their business. If you look 25, 30 years on and you look at the authorised reps of today, there's very, very little difference between them and brokerages or in terms of their professionalism, or it's so different now.
Yeah, look, I don't think you can really tell the difference. And in fact, Resilium have got some businesses around the place. In fact, in the partner business, and in fact, there's one in Brisbane called Cornerstone and another one on the Gold Coast called Insurance Mentor. And you wouldn't know whether they're an AR or a broker. You walk into their office, you would not have a clue. And that begs the question, why as a small business, you know, let's say you've got 20 or 30 employees, why you would want to be a license holder? I just can't see the benefit of all the overarching compliance and maintaining your license, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We go into an AR model with a dealer split and
and run that. That's just a personal view. You know, I can imagine that people want to keep their independence as a broker, but, you know, I think coming back to your point, the ARs and the brokers, there is very little difference. And what, I don't care which AR model it is, whether it's Brazilian or Steadfast or Aussure, Advisor Select, whoever it is, you know, they're all offering a decent product and giving the overarching compliance support and whatnot. And I think that's a great model. And I think it's good for the industry. And in fact, you know, if I was ASIC, I'd rather be supervising 30 AR networks and the internationals than, you know, a whole load of brokers and ARs, everything else, if I could slim it down.
Paul Einem, if I was to ask you to go back to that young fella that left school and decided to go out and get a job, and you were able to give him some advice, what would you say to him?
I'll tell you what I'd say to him, and I said it to my nephew, who in his early 20s was at university on the North Coast in Queensland, and he was going to be an accountant. And I said, you're crazy. You're crazy. You need to get into insurance. Insurance is where you need to be. And you know, he thought I was a bit crazy, but he went and got himself a job at Aon in Brisbane and he did really well. And in fact, right now he's just scored the job of the North American FACRI head for Willis Re. So, you know, that's what I wish somebody had said to me. I went about it the long way. And in fact, I tripped into insurance. Would I have thought, I only know two people who have ever gone into insurance, who have left school and said, I'm going to go. And these are people of my vintage. I mean, it may happen a little bit today, but probably not. But yeah, my advice would have been get into insurance, but only because I've been either that or a commercial litigator. I don't know.
They both involve a whole heap of counselling, Paul.
Well, yeah, one you've got to study pretty hard for.
Hey, I wanted to ask you two final questions. The first one is, you know, like your nephew, if there are people out there that are wanting to advance their career, what advice would you provide them?
I think you've got to take risks and I think you've got to challenge yourself. If you're happy to sit in a role and do it, that's fine. There's a whole load of people out there that want to do that. But if you want to advance your career, I think you've got to talk to the leaders in your business. You've got to demonstrate that that's what you want to do. Don't make life hard for yourself. You don't want to be that guy. You know, just get in there and dig in, show that you want to advance and it will happen. I mean, insurance, you can go anywhere. There is just no doubt about that. Insurance, you can go anywhere. For a young single bloke or girl, or even if they're married, doesn't matter. If you want to travel, you can go anywhere. You can work anywhere. The world's your oyster. And there's not a whole lot of professions in the world that you can do that.
And that's exactly right. That's the one aspect of our business that I don't think we advertise particularly well. And it really doesn't matter what qualification you've got. You know, you mentioned actuaries. You could have a degree in marketing. You could have an accounting degree. You could have a Bachelor of Arts degree. It really doesn't matter. We could use those people, couldn't we?
You know, actuaries are making all the money. They're doing extraordinarily well. But, you know, if you were going to market insurance and you were going to want to get people on, I mean, the video that you could make would be extraordinary because what you can do and where you can go and the times that you can have, you know, people should be knocking your door down.
Final question for you, sir. What's next for Paul Lynham?
What's next for me is I'm on my last stop. So I will stay at Adonna, until I retire.
Does it feel good to say that?
It's not great because I went into COVID, I was 55 and I came out, I was 58. And I thought, what happened there? You know, I'm 58, you're knocking on 60. So you think, oh, no. But, you know, it is what it is. I expect to work for the probably up until I'm 65 plus. If my health is on my side, I'll continue to work. My wife plays golf. We live at Sanctuary Cove and she plays golf on the two courses here a few times a week. She says, why don't you play golf? And I said, because I like working. I'm not a great golfer. I'm actually okay at working.
I think you're more than okay. Paul Lynham, thank you so much for spending some time with us on Business Made Personal, my friend.
It's great. My pleasure.
Thank you so much for lending us your ears. Please remember to click follow on your podcast app or subscribe at bmppodcast.com.au so we can give you a sneak peek of our next guest. Until next time, I'm Mark Silvera and you've been listening to Business Made Personal.